ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the mining industry facing tough questions about workplace safety after a worker dies in a mine collapse in Victoria. Also, the Treasurer warns Australians there won't be any cash splashes in May's federal budget. And oyster farmers forced to stop their harvest as a marine heatwave takes hold.
We've had just unseasonably warm water and it's created algae blooms. I haven't seen this before, but when it's 28, 29 degrees, I don't like it.
First tonight, Victoria's workplace safety regulator has launched an investigation into a mine collapse at Ballarat yesterday that killed one miner and badly injured another. The Australian Workers' Union claims the death of 37-year-old Kurt Hourigan was avoidable and alleges the company in charge of the mine had ignored workers' safety concerns. Mining has the third highest fatality rate of all Australian industries, and workplace safety experts say standards on mine sites need to improve. This report from John Daly.
Friends have been posting tributes today to 37-year-old father Kurt Hourigan, who's been named as the gold miner killed in a mine collapse 500 metres underground in Western Victoria yesterday afternoon. Investigators from the state's workplace safety watchdog worked through the night trying to figure out just what led to his death and life-threatening injuries to another 21-year-old miner.
I'm here today because of the very tragic circumstances that occurred last night where a young man has lost his life in the mine. Mining is an inherently dangerous industry. It's tragic circumstances, and we've also got another young man who's fighting for his life in hospital.
28 other miners managed to scramble to an underground safety pod after the rockfall struck. WorkSafe Victoria Executive Director of Health and Safety, Narelle Beer, says investigators will try to determine whether safety breaches or negligence were at play.
So we'll conduct a thorough investigation. We'll look at all avenues to understand what led up to the situation, what systems of safety we have in place, and whether there's been any breaches of the regulations. And we'll certainly try to understand if there's anything that could have been prevented or avoided, or if there's any recklessness or negligence in that process. That will be a matter of the investigation, and that will be also similar to a coronial investigation.
The Australian Workers' Union alleges the death was avoidable and claims workers' previous concerns about safety fell on deaf ears, as one union representative put it. It also claims the mine operator, Victory Minerals, had made a safety manager redundant months before the tragedy. WorkSafe's Narelle Beer again.
I'm unaware of that. All I can say is that we will do a thorough investigation, and clearly we'll be looking at what caused the incident, what led to or contributed to the incident, and we will be reporting on that. And if as a result of that there is a prosecution that will follow, then that matter will be prosecuted accordingly.
In a statement, Victory Minerals says it will cooperate fully with this investigation and be undertaking its own. The company says the safety of its workers is its first priority, and that no safety professionals working underground in the mine were made redundant in a recent restructure. Michael Quinlan is an occupational health and safety expert at the University of New South Wales. He was also one of the independent investigators that looked into the Beaconsfield mine collapse in Tasmania in 2006. He says mining deaths rarely occur without prior warning.
They need to look at to see if there were any signs. I mean, my experience with mining is very few people die in mines without clear warning signals of something being wrong prior to the event. And so you'll obviously need to be looking to see what was known about the strata, were concerns being expressed, and if they were being expressed, what was being done about it, and whether the law and enforcement, whether the mine was being regularly inspected and adequately inspected.
Seven miners died at work in Australia last year, and two have died so far this year. As an industry, mining has the third highest fatality rate in Australia, with an average fatality rate of 3.8 workers for every 100,000 on site. That's double the rate across all industries of 1.4 workers. Michael Quinlan says deaths on mine sites have dropped a lot since mining safety legislation was overhauled following a series of mining disasters in the 1980s and 1990s. And while things are better, there is still cause for concern.
Up until Grosvenor in 2020, we really hadn't had a major or near. Grosvenor was as about as close as you ever want to get to a major mine disaster, but we haven't had a major multiple fatality event. However, in relation to single fatalities, for the last decade, if not longer, there's been no net improvement in mine safety at that level. And given the increasing use of contractors, there's some concerns that that might actually start to go backwards. So that's the real challenge for the industry.
Michael Quinlan from the University of New South Wales, ending that report from John Daly. The Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, is warning struggling Australian households there won't be any big cash splashes in the May budget. Dr. Chalmers told a gathering of business figures in Sydney today the budget will be one of spending restraint as government revenue drops because of falling iron ore prices and a weaker labour market. He's still hoping, though, that he can produce another budget surplus. Our reporter David Taylor has more.
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says he's going to use the May budget to put the economy on a diet.
When we say that there will be a bigger emphasis on growth in this budget, we mean it. But we also mean sustainable growth. Think of it as protein, not just carbs.
So while there will be additional cost of living relief for low and middle income households, there's no financial sugar hit or cash splash.
We see cost of living help as a way of taking the pressure off inflation, not adding to it. Anything that's too costly, too splashy, risks undoing the good progress that we have made together on inflation.
Jim Chalmers is trying to whip the economy into shape as revenue growth slows, expenses lift, and some dark economic clouds gather overseas. Specifically, the government's looking at falling iron ore and coal prices, leading to less tax from mining companies, and tens of thousands of jobs have been shed recently, meaning less income tax revenue.
In each of our first two budgets, we benefited from more than $100 billion in revenue upgrades. And this year, we won't see anything like that. In fact, we're even looking at much less than the $69 billion we booked in the last mid-year budget update.
As for the new spending in this year's budget, the Treasurer says, somewhat unusually, most of it has actually already been announced.
A big increase in defence spending, responding to the Defence Strategic Review. Paying the super guarantee on paid parental leave as part of Katie's gender equality strategy. Substantial investments in remote housing as part of closing the gap. The next steps in our Southeast Asian economic strategy, timed for announcement at ASEAN in Melbourne. Reducing compliance costs for business by abolishing almost 500 nuisance tariffs. And perhaps most substantial of all, our cost of living tax cuts announced in January.
Last financial year, the government banked much of its $22 billion surplus, which came thanks to record low unemployment and soaring commodities prices. This financial year, the surplus is estimated by Treasury to be $9 billion.
There will still be a primary focus, but perhaps not a sole focus, on inflation. There'll be revenue upgrades, and we will bank what we can from them. We are still shooting for that second surplus.
Independent economist Chris Richardson has decades of experience analysing government budgets. He says today the Treasurer Jim Chalmers gave a gentle reminder to households not to expect too much in this year's federal budget.
He should do things like raise Commonwealth rent assistance. But as he spends with one hand, he would need to take that money back, cut spending or raise taxes with the other hand, so that the net impact of the budget on the Reserve Bank's task of tackling inflation doesn't get any harder. He needs to walk and chew gum. If you do it, you can still help the 40% of Australians who don't benefit from the tax cuts that are coming.
So the obvious question then, who is likely to cop it in the May budget?
So far, nobody, or at least I don't think so. There's going to be an absence of extra moves, extra help for a bunch of people. I don't think anybody's terribly in the firing line.
But what about the government's big ticket items like nuclear subs, the NDIS, aged care and interest payments on debt? Are they still affordable? Westpac's chief economist, Lucy Ellis.
There will have to be plans about how those are managed, but at this stage, Australia is in the enviable position of running a budget surplus. And while ever we have non-indexed tax brackets, bracket creep and high commodity prices boosting corporate tax, we are going to have these revenue surprises.
The budget will be handed down by the Federal Treasurer on Tuesday, May 14.
David Taylor reporting. Australian Palestinians are calling on the government to explain and reverse the sudden cancellation of visas granted to people fleeing Gaza. Having finally made it out, several Palestinians with connections to Australia have found themselves stranded in other countries after their visas were withdrawn. Little explanation has been given by authorities, and one former Immigration Department boss says it's a stark contrast to the handling of visas for families who fled Ukraine. Jacqueline Breen has more.
Palestinian-Australian writer Sama Sabwi is a long way from her home in Melbourne. She's currently in Cairo, where she's been trying to help family and friends make it out of Gaza alive.
When people come out of Gaza, they've risked so much to make it to the border. They've paid so much money to make it out of Gaza. And they come here devastated. They've all witnessed horrific things, lived through terrible losses. And they come here and they breathe and then they say, all right, now, you know, I've got my visa in hand and I can go somewhere safe, secure, where I could just be surrounded by my loved ones.
But for several Palestinians that the ABC is aware of, that hasn't happened. Their temporary visas, which were previously granted, were suddenly cancelled as they prepared to leave for Australia. In the case of one woman who'd secured visas for herself and her children in November, the news of the cancellation came after they'd escaped Gaza and were already transiting to Australia. The notification she received said it had been determined that she'd never intended to only stay temporarily in Australia. Nasser Mashni is from the Australian Palestinian Advocacy Network.
It's an absurd bureaucratic backflip. There can be no question. Gaza was uninhabitable, according to the United Nations, in 2020. That was 4 years ago. There can be no question in the department's mind when they issued these visas that these people were looking for safety.
Well, that sounds bizarre.
Former Immigration Department Secretary Abul Rizvi says the explanation doesn't wash.
I mean, the Department of Home Affairs would have known the bulk of these people did not intend a genuine visit. Their ability to go back to Gaza is very, very limited. It was obvious they were going to seek to extend stay in Australia. To suddenly decide that they're not going to seek to extend stay in Australia, it just seems to be a bizarre explanation.
There's been no clarification from the government, with a spokesperson for the Home Affairs Minister saying they can't comment on individual cases for privacy reasons. The statement then refers generally to ongoing security checks for all applicants, without saying if that concern's relevant in these cases. Opposition leader Peter Dutton, who's repeatedly argued that security checks and the granting of visas to Palestinians has been rushed, said today that the visa cancellations were proof of that. Abul Rizvi says an explanation from the government is needed, especially if there's been a change of policy.
Well, if the policy was that these people should not be issued a visitor visa because the likelihood of them seeking to extend stay in Australia after arrival was a concern, then they should have never been granted the visa in the first place. It seems to me that there may have been a change in policy without, I think, an adequate explanation from the government. But we need to remember, for example, if we contrast this situation with that of Ukraine, we were granting humanitarian stay visas as well as large numbers of visitor visas out of Ukraine when it was patently obvious the people fleeing Ukraine could not easily go back to Ukraine.
Why the difference?
That's a very good question, and that's a question that I think both the Labor Party and Mr. Dutton should answer.
Nasser Mashni says it's hard to put into words the extent to which Palestinian Australians feel abandoned by their government, and he wants every effort possible made to help those currently stranded.
It's a compound on grief, on suffering. We've been let down by our government time after time. We're in day 159.
in what the International Court of Justice said was a plausible genocide.
Between October and February, the government's granted 2,200 temporary visas for Palestinians and 2,400 for Israelis. It's believed the number of Palestinians granted visas who've arrived in Australia is much lower, but the number hasn't been provided by the government.
Jacqueline Breen reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, New South Wales oyster farmers forced to stop their harvest as a marine heatwave takes hold. The Russian presidential election is on this weekend, and it's all but guaranteed that Vladimir Putin will win a fifth six-year term. Will Partlett is an associate professor at the University of Melbourne's Law School and a keen observer of Russia. He told me, apart from Putin, there are three other candidates in the election, all approved by the Kremlin.
So the Kremlin has used its control over the Central Election Commission to basically disqualify any candidate who opposes the war from running against Putin, and instead have allowed the kind of the usual suspects from the kind of what they call the systematic opposition, the kind of loyal opposition, very loyal opposition in this case, to run against Putin, to essentially just be kind of patsies to be there. And the real question now is really whether Putin will get more than 75% of the vote, which, you know, I think is probably likely given, particularly given how they can manipulate some of the numbers using electronic voting.
Why is that 75% so critical?
In Russia, elections are about performance of power, about demonstration of strengths and stability. So the number really matters. And in this case, Putin wants to show not just to the Russian people, but also to international audiences that he, you know, that the war, you know, he's a popular war president, that, you know, he's got a higher percentage of Russians supporting him than ever in the past, and that the war is going well. So it's really it's a kind of theatrical exercise.
So if he gets that 75% of votes, what do we know about the people voting for him? Have they done so voluntarily?
Yeah, look, a lot of people will be bussed in because they work for the Russian state. They've been pressured to vote a certain way. He does have some general support. I mean, of course, he controls all the media. So, you know, anyone who is potentially trying to criticize the government has been put in prison. So it's very difficult to say that, you know, that people are voting in any way, in a real way, given that the political information that they get has been curated for decades to basically show how great Putin is, how well the war's going, and, you know, how you know, they need to vote again for their great leader. So it really is in no way a reflection, I think, of what a competitive election would look like in a kind of open, pluralistic media market or kind of a situation.
So you're expecting Vladimir Putin will be re-elected president for a fifth term of 6 years. What will that mean for Russia?
Well, look, I think it's, you know, the Kremlin will very much portray this in their messaging as a show of strength. In reality, some of the work that I'm doing in a forthcoming book suggests actually that the more centralized, the more personalized the system becomes, and of course it will only become more personalized and centralized with a fifth presidential term, more than 20 years in power, that Russia will get less, you know, governance will weaken, it will become more dysfunctional, you know, they'll be unable to deliver on the kind of basics of healthcare, schools, and so forth. And, you know, even institutions like the Russian military will continue to weaken, as we've seen. The Russian military has performed very poorly, given, you know, the Russia's kind of size and military background. So I think, we have a potentially much more dysfunctional Russia, but also a dangerous one because it's very insecure. And I think we're seeing some of that, you know, an insecure government, an insecure Putin who knows this weakness but wants to lash out to try to avoid collapse or to avoid looking weak.
And what do you think that'll mean then for the war in Ukraine and Russia's actions towards the rest of the world?
Well, look, I think after this, the Putin regime will focus very heavily on the U.S. presidential election. They know that if Donald Trump wins, that will put them in a very strong position in Ukraine. So I think there will be a lot of focus on trying to, interfere or, you know, whip up on social media and so forth, pro-Trump supporters and attack Biden and so forth and so on. So I think we'll see that. I think they're also going to try to continue to take the initiative here because they're on, to some extent, the front foot in the actual war itself. As in the spring, as Ukraine is really struggling with, you know, shortages of supplies and ammunition and so forth. So I think we're going to see quite an aggressive Kremlin at least in the short term in the war in Ukraine, and in its kind of social media activity and so forth in the US presidential election.
Associate Professor Will Partlett from the University of Melbourne. Pharmacies are to get billions of dollars in extra funding from the federal government in a new deal that health experts say could change healthcare in Australia. The agreement follows last year's angry campaign by pharmacists after the government doubled prescription lengths to 60 days for some medicines. The Pharmacy Guild claimed the move would bankrupt some businesses. Stephanie Smale reports.
For pharmacist Asim Iqbal, who owns and runs a pharmacy in Wollongong, the change from 30-day scripts to 60-day scripts that pitted pharmacists against the federal government is having an impact on his business's bottom line.
We're seeing quite a number of 60-day dispensing scripts come through, and that has affected us financially.
And what has been the flow on from that for you?
Look, it's been difficult. Some of the full-time staff members, like a few, have left for one reason or another, and some people haven't been replaced. So we're trying to run a tighter ship.
When the 60-day script fight started last year, Pharmacy Guild President Trent Toomey tearfully declared pharmacists would go bankrupt under the change.
I had one young woman this morning in her 30s, single mum. She got her dad to put her house up as equity to buy her first pharmacy. She will be bankrupt. If those spin doctors down there don't want to believe what I've got to say, get off your ass and go and talk to these guys.
It's well known the Pharmacy Guild is a powerful lobby group, but the federal government did push ahead with the plan, rolling out its first stage in September last year. And it appears both sides have moved on, reaching agreement over the broader funding deal that will keep pharmacies going for the next 5 years. The details are still being finalised, but in a statement, the Health Minister, Mark Butler, says pharmacies will get an extra $3 billion over that period on top of existing funding. Pharmacist Asim Iqbal says that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, look, without the next agreement coming into place and without the certainty that that agreement provides, it is very difficult to invest in staff, in equipment, etc. These agreements effectively provides both the pharmacy sector and the government with stability, so it works both ways.
And he's hoping it's time for pharmacies to take on a bigger healthcare role in Australia.
People see the importance moving forward of pharmacies and increasing our scope of practice so that we can take some of the pressure off GPs, we can take some of the pressure off hospitals.
So why do pharmacies need so much federal government funding? Peter Braden is the director of the Grattan Institute's health program.
Well, it's the same as, for example, most GP practices. They'll be operated in some ways just like a small business, but they're funded through the Medicare benefits schedule. So most of the income comes from government. It's the same in pharmacies where the pharmaceutical benefits schedule and other kinds of payments and support make it viable, but patients pay out of pocket as well.
Peter Braden explains the last funding deal for pharmacies was about $18 billion over 5 years.
The deal with the government is a much bigger picture question. It goes well beyond 60-day dispensing to all the fees, charges and services that the government supports in community pharmacy. My hope is that, you know, we've put that disagreement behind us and it didn't really have too much of a bearing on this bigger picture agreement.
Peter Braden says it's not just the size of the funding boost, but where it's going to go that's important, acknowledging many pharmacies aren't struggling to keep their doors open. And he argues that giving pharmacists a bigger role with services like vaccination and some prescribing powers are among the changes needed.
There is potential for a turning point here. We've seen the rapid rollout of pharmacy vaccination, and we've seen lots of models around the world where pharmacies do more. And at a time when people are struggling to get in to see a doctor, when fees are rising, it's really important that we make the most of community pharmacy.
The Pharmacy Guild says the finer details are being negotiated, but it's hoped the new deal will be in place by the new financial year.
Stephanie Smale reporting. Oyster farmers on the south coast of New South Wales have had to stop the harvest as a record-breaking marine heatwave continues. Murrimbula Lake has had water temperatures of up to 29 degrees, and the warm water has triggered the growth of algal blooms. The oyster farmers say they've never seen anything like it. Our reporter Josh Becker from ABC South East New South Wales has been following the story. Josh, first off, tell us about the oyster industry at Lake Murrimbula and how it's being affected by this heatwave.
Well, in Murrimbula, this estuary is one of the most productive oyster estuaries in New South Wales. 1 million dozen oysters were sold out of that estuary in the past year. The hot water at the moment, it's creating these ideal conditions for algal blooms, which leads to Vibrio, which is an illness linked to the consumption of seafood, which essentially means that these oysters are unsafe to eat. So as a precaution, the farmers have come together with the New South Wales Food Authority and decided to close for harvest while they've got these elevated temperatures and elevated instances of algal blooms, just as a precaution to make sure that they're doing the right thing for consumers. So for oyster farmers, this means they have to pause and unable to harvest, which has a flow-on effects for them with their cash flow, and they're unable to trade at this point. Farmers are saying that they haven't seen it at elevated temperatures like this before.
So Josh, just how worried are the farmers about what this might mean for their industry?
I think for farmers, they've been warned about the effects of climate change and that they would be on the front line of it. And they've already seen some examples of how it's affecting them already. There are those cash flow elements that are an immediate effect on the farmers. But I spoke with Dominic Boyton from Murrimbula Gourmet Oysters, and he says that he has never seen these extended high temperatures in Murrimbula Lake.
We've had just unseasonably warm water, and it's created algae blooms and all sorts of strange things happening out on the water. So we, Murrimbula Lake, just went, we're going to close, precautionary, make sure our oysters are good. And the shelf life on them at the moment is limited because they're really fat and we just don't want to push our luck.
Was that a decision made in consultation with the Food Authority around a precautionary closure?
It was, and the other farmers, and we just decided Murrimbula sells a lot of oysters, so we just wanted to make sure we kept our good reputation and kept everyone safe.
Estuaries are often closed for harvest, as I understand it, based on salinity measures, particularly when there's rain. I haven't heard of it being closed due to water temperatures. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
I haven't seen this before, but we haven't seen, I mean, Murrimbula Lake does get warm, but when it's 28, 29 degrees, it's just not, I don't like it.
In your mind, is this part of the effects of climate change?
Yeah, climate change, climate shift. I'm not sure how you want to put it, but it certainly seems that we're getting more warmer events further south, and our local creatures are just not used to it. I think it's a little window into what's going to be the future.
That's Murrimbula oyster farmer Dominic Boynter. So, Josh, what are the scientists saying about this?
Scientists are saying that this is clearly linked to the effects of climate change. I spoke with Professor Shauna Murray from the University of Technology in Sydney, and she says this phenomenon is going to become more and more common.
We did predict a marine heatwave for this year because we have been seeing increasingly warm temperatures in the estuaries along the New South Wales coastline. And in fact, a study a couple of years ago showed that these estuaries have already increased in temperature by about 2 degrees just in the past 11 years. So they're warming quite quickly. So it's not really a surprise.
Have you heard of estuaries closing due to water temperatures before?
Yeah, it happens rarely, occasionally. And it's just going to happen more and more frequently going into the future. Yeah, the data does show that it's a very clear trend of increasing, and not just increasing at a remarkably fast rate.
Professor Shauna Murray from the University of Technology in Sydney. And Josh, do we know just how long the oyster harvest may need to stay on hold?
Oyster farmers will be testing regularly, weekly tests. They'll do tests of the oyster meat as well as measuring water samples over the course of the week. Oyster farmers are hopeful that they'll be able to serve oysters for Easter this year, which is a key selling part of their season. But there's also the prospect that it could go longer than that and be more than a month. So it's one that they're watching very closely.
Our reporter Josh Becker from ABC Southeast New South Wales. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. That's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. Tomorrow they'll have more on the Russian presidential election. We'll be back tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Decades ago, when other countries were embracing nuclear power, Australia put a ban on it. Now the federal opposition wants to lift that ban and build nuclear power plants on the sites of ageing coal-fired power stations. Today, we look into the feasibility of that idea. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.